Five, four, three, two, one.
What's the situation, Captain?
This is Situation Fluxus, a weekly one-hour program focused on jazz and improvised music, news, radio, conversations, and more. Thank you for tuning in to Situation Fluxus, produced in upstate New York for WGXC 90.7 FM, listener-supported radio for open ears. I'm your host, Cheryl Kay. There'll be no news this week. I hope you enjoy both of my interviews today. My guest is New York City-based trombonist and composer Sam Blakesley. His second and latest release with his group Wistful Thinking is Busybody, out now on Outside in Music. So, Sam, I want to thank you for joining me on Situation Fluxus.
Thanks for having me.
Your debut release, 2021's The Long Middle, with saxophonist Chris Coles, guitarist Brandon Coleman, and bassist Matt Wiles, was, quote, a meditation on isolation and distance in a chamber jazz setting. Busybody added percussionist and drummer Jamie Haddad and Dan Pugach,
yeah,
respectively, and woodwind player Brian Kroc. In contrast, obviously, with more players, Busybody has a fuller sound than The Long Middle. Also, the addition of electronics. But comparatively, they share cohesiveness, and I think that is you and those feelings of isolation and distance. But it sounds as though you've had a breakthrough of sorts in Busybody. That's my $10 coffee table analysis. Am I close?
That's good, yeah. Yeah, I think that... Busybody was such a divergent kind of departure from the acoustic chamber jazz setting, not only because of the way in which it was recorded, like with The Long Middle, it was a very characteristic jazz studio record, live takes, no editing really to it at all. Whereas Busybody just kind of sprung forth. We started working on it in May 2020. And it was wrapped up in September 2020. It was recorded all remotely. And it was a really interesting experience because me and the producer, Brandon Coleman, who also plays guitar on the record, we really tried to pursue it in a sense of, we're not going to try to recreate a jazz quintet record, but just use this medium that we all found ourselves in the unfortunate circumstances of the pandemic. And it really was kind of a unique challenge as a composer and instrumentalist, because before that time, I didn't own a microphone at home. I had never used Logic or done any electronic music. So it was really kind of flying by the seat of my pants adventure. But by the time that we finished about two or three songs that were just kind of fun passion projects at the time, I didn't really anticipate making an album out of it. And I kind of thought, there's actually some potential to kind of continue going down this pathway of a more electronic approach and different soundscapes and manipulating acoustic instruments in the kind of digital setting. So it was really interesting process to kind of compare the two. And I initially wanted to release it as a double album, having like an acoustic side and electric side. And the label that Outside In that I was working with kind of helped me say, no, these are good to stand alone and release separately. So, yeah.
And what about that personal transition from one release to the other?
It's kind of interesting because the musically, they were both happening like all at the same time. We recorded the studio album in August 2020. So we had a little bit of live playing there for The Long Middle, but everything was kind of happening between May and September 2020. And I think it's well, all was musically around the same time. Having the releases a year apart really helped me kind of understand the better ways to get the music out there, how to present it more honestly, you know, also not get too attached to results that you maybe are expecting or wanting from it, you know. So all these things that by the time the second one came out, I just was extremely excited to have the music be there and be documented more than anything else. And especially kind of document collaboration that was with Ohio musicians mainly on this record, mm-hmm. where I'm from. So that was really important to me to document it with them. But
yeah. Well, even the artwork of the album covers is, it says something, I don't know what, but for The Long Middle, it has a pop art cover. Mm. And Busybody, it's a photograph of which bridge?
Brooklyn Bridge.
Brooklyn Bridge.
Yeah. I was at Brooklyn Bridge Park for that one and just kind of turned out to be a nice photo. So I thought, why not?
Yeah.
But it's interesting because, you know, that was the first time for Busybody. I did the CD design myself and the jacket and everything. And it was kind of interesting to take full control over every aspect of it. And I think that it's kind of interesting how they maybe created that almost more divergence between the two of even how it's being packaged and people expecting a certain thing. And then the next one came out and talking to other people in the press or anything about Busybody, they're like, man, I really wasn't anticipating this based on your last one. And that's exactly kind of what I wanted. So,
yeah. So what kind of wizardry did you use on your solos for Little Song Diary Part 1 and Little Song Diary Part 2?
So a lot of what I kind of thought about in making that record, especially in the times when I was just completely by myself, was I kind of started trying to use my trombone just simply as a MIDI controller. I play a little bit of piano, but not in a sense that I'd want to really release it too much, you know, or do it in a live setting rather. And what I did was I would just record acoustic kind of improvisations. And then within the program, I started adding lots of kind of, I believe they're called like FAT effects, P-H-A-T effects. And what they do is they take it through different sorts of ring modulators and different types of saturation, as well as on that one, I believe I used pitch shifters. So I created essentially a chord happening with every note based off of what note I was playing. So it kind of created this layered sound that, you know, I was trying to disguise as much that it's just me as possible, you know, and have mm-hmm. it be something completely unrelated, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. Though I didn't understand a word you just said, but yeah, it makes sense.
A lot of it is taking the same same types of effects that like a really good keyboard player or synthesizer player would do, where they have different settings on their keyboard. I was essentially just doing that within a plugin in the program. So
at some point during the pandemic, Sam, the Catskill Mountain region of upstate New York became a refuge, as you wrote for The Long Middle. And I'm going to read something that you wrote. I'm going to quote you. During this period, The reservoir and the Catskills in general have become an integral part of balancing my art and life. I have also been fascinated with the duality in this particular location, that something so serene and still can provide water and lifeblood to such a chaotic place like New York City. My question to you, Sam, is, has busybody brought you closer to life balance?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think I moved to New York in 2017, and life balance was not a part of my daily vocabulary, you know. And I think it really has shown me that, you know, art moves in really long time periods, or creativity works in long time periods, and as well as rest and creating time to just breathe and be present. And I think a lot of it, in kind of going up there so frequently, it really helped kind of temper that extreme sense of self that I think solo artists in a digital age kind of can tap into, where I've got to be promoting myself and I have to, this is my universe that I'm trying to expand, as opposed to just kind of being in the world more. And it really, and the Catskill regions in general, just really became a huge part of my life, of kind of escaping from my noisy Bedford Avenue, Brooklyn apartment, you know. But it's become really a really big part of my life. And I think that it allowed me to just take a step back and think about what I'm really hearing, as opposed to, as a composer or instrumentalist, as opposed to what I think people want to hear, or trying to fit myself into someone else's trajectory that is successful or something like that. So when I get up into that kind of expansive environment, it just really helps temper that sense of ego that is always intertwined with what we do as artists, you know.
The trick with walking the Ashokan is not getting pecked by one of the those geese.
Yeah, right.
And skipping around all the poop that they leave on the trail.
That's right.
Oh gosh, yeah, it's a beautiful area. I have spent many a time just walking there just to clear my head. For musicians and composers, I believe keeping busy at their craft during the last almost 3 years was and is indicative of that inherent drive to create and explore. What did you find out about yourself and your creative process, Sam?
Well, I think that I kind of had this a sense of return almost. When I was living in Ohio, that's where I went to school and stayed there for 4 years after school. And it's a much smaller scene. So it's kind of just like an open pasture of exploration. And it's very easy to book gigs. It's very easy to get musicians together to do lots of different things. And at that time, I was really focusing a lot on my own compositions, and especially writing for my big band. I was doing that a lot. And then I moved to New York, and I was so immersed in just trying to meet people and kind of get into the scene as a trombonist that a lot of that kind of personal direction just went by the wayside for the first few years. And I kind of realized that about, I don't know, I'd say about 5 or 6 months into the pandemic, I just wasn't missing being a sideman that much. Like, I was really missing playing music, and I was really missing the human connection between people. But at the same time, my mind, for the first time since moving, kind of felt quiet enough to actually move forward with something of my own. And I think that's kind of where this wellspring of documenting these albums came from, is just having a second to just focus on my own craft as an individual. And without you know, I think New York can be a double-edged sword, where you're constantly surrounded by so many creative voices and so many different cultures within the music. But then it can also be really distracting, because it made me feel, at least, like I had to sound like this person and sound like that person and do this and do that. Where when all of that kind of went away, these albums just kind of came out of thin air, essentially. So in a way, it was kind of returning to more of my own individual voice during that time. Mm-hmm. And now it's more in balance with the two, I think. But
like a novelist, music composers sometimes are writing for several projects. Currently, which of your ensembles are you writing for?
Well, right now I'm pretty much focusing 110% on my big band, which is the Sam Blakeslee Large Group. And I've ran it for 10 years now, or 9 3/4 almost. So I'm getting there. And that's been, you know, something that I've kind of come back to off and on, and it's been difficult in New York to find venues to play at. And, it's also just financially difficult, but we're luckily, there's been some steam building with that. And, we're going to be playing at Birdland on the 19th of February. And then we're going to be recording almost 2 albums of music, in the first week of May at Octavin Studios in Mount Vernon. So, I think I have 16 pieces that we'll be recording then, trying to get 2 albums of music. And that's kind of been all consuming the last month or two, but it's good. So I'm excited to be finally just focusing on that for a second.
You grew up in Columbus, Ohio. Columbus is southwest of Cleveland. And as you know, Sam, I recently spoke with Daniel Peck of the Bop Stop in Cleveland. And he spoke warmly of the deep love of jazz there. How does Columbus compare?
Well, Columbus is, it's a little bit different. I think that it's a very different kind of town economically. And it's a much newer town. So I think that with cities like Cleveland or Pittsburgh or Detroit or these kind of quintessential Rust Belt cities, you know, there's also a huge amount of arts funding that is left over from the philanthropists of the Gilded Age, essentially, in those cities. And I think that there's maybe a little more like forward thinking, or it's a little more contemporary scene in Cleveland. But then in Columbus, it's like probably one of the most swinging cities in the country, you know, so it's kind of amazing how these two places can be 2 hours apart and have such radically different music scenes. Mm-hmm. I think the fact that, you know, I'm a Buckeyes fan, OSU, but I think that also has a big impact on the town, where it's much more like sports centric than arts centric. And I think in Cleveland, there's just a really long time appreciation of the arts across all disciplines, and also just an incredibly rich history of people coming from Cleveland. Tad Dameron, Joe Lovano, people that are still there, like Ernie Krivda and Jack Shantz. I mean, there's just some remarkable musicians to come out of there. And all my younger friends like Chris Coles and Theron Brown that are just doing remarkable things. And it's always really fun for me to bring musicians back from New York to play at some of those clubs with those musicians, because I think they kind of think, all right, I'm going to Akron or Cleveland, let's see what this is going to be. And then they get there and they're like, oh man, this is really, really good. It's like, yeah. So, you know, I've really come to appreciate what New York has to offer, and then what all the different regional scenes have to offer. You know, I like them all for different reasons, but they're very different from town to town, definitely.
Well, Let me give you the last word, Sam. Is there something you'd like us to know? You've already mentioned an upcoming gig on February 19th.
Yep, we're playing the Birdland on February 19th. And then I mentioned the studio recording for the big band. But right now, between it launched on January 28th and it'll be running until mid-April, but we are doing a crowdfunding campaign to help cover the costs, trying to raise $30,000, which would go to musician fees, studio time, catering for musicians, the mixing and mastering. And then I'm prepared to make a significant personal contribution for the distribution and printing of the records. But simply with that many people and that much music, I need some help. So if there's anyone that's willing to donate, it would be much appreciated. So.
That was my interview with composer and trombonist Sam Blakeslee. For more information, samblakesleemusic.com. You're listening to Situation Fluxus. I'm your host, Cheryl Kay. Please send your comments, quips, and anecdotes, as well as feedback to thejazzdisturbance@gmail.com. For more information about the show, jazzfluxus.com. And here's my interview from last Sunday with Kat Henry on the other show that I host, The Jazz Disturbance.
There was a time, simple it was, no matter that eluded us, feelings of strain hidden beneath it all. There was a time, honest was he, leading off to prosperity, feelings of greed fed all deceit.
Of the Jazz Disturbance on WGXC 90.7 FM, listener-supported radio for open ears. My interview today is with Kat Henry, arts executive and curator of the 2023 Hudson Jazz Festival. This year's festival is titled The Shape of Jazz Today, scheduled over two weekends, February 16th through February 19th, and February 23rd through February 26. Hudson Hall is located at 327 Warren Street in Hudson, New York. This interview was recorded on January 25th. So, thank you for joining us, Kat.
It's lovely to be here, Cheryl. Thank you.
Yes. You've curated the Hudson Jazz Festival since 2020. What brought you to Hudson with such a lengthy career in New York City?
Well, you know, the pandemic and lockdown and post-lockdown changed a lot of things for everyone in the arts world. And especially in the music world, you know, when everything ground to a halt and we had months and months of not really understanding where things were going. And it was a time at which I stepped away from Jazz at Lincoln Center, where I had worked for many, many years. And I started connecting with people to just check on them and see how they were doing, and you know, the connected networks that we had to try and help musicians find work, find money, find support in all kinds of different ways. And through those connections, I was introduced to the folks at Hudson Hall, and I got to visit in the summer of 2020, which got me out of New York City, which was I was very grateful for. And I had been to Hudson before. I had been to Hudson in 1995. And it's funny because some of the galleries are still there. And although I still live in Brooklyn, I visit Hudson often. And I began a relationship with the amazing team at Hudson Hall and was just inspired by their vision for both the hall and for jazz in the city. And a way to just bring the community together. And I was thrilled. And we had time, of course, to try and figure out where the festival and the hall was going next as everything was on pause.
So let's talk about the 2023 Hudson Jazz Festival, The Shape of Jazz Today. It opens with a party. Wait a minute. Partay! On Thursday, February 16th, and an exhibition with the works of painter Maureen Penvern titled Body and Soul. She's one of two local participants in the festival that I recognize, the other being bassist Michelle Nadeggiacello. How does Ms. Penvern's work fit with the theme of this year's festival?
Well, Maureen, who is originally from France, has lived in the United States for almost the same amount of time as I have, coming from London. We both moved here in the 90s, and she began her career in America with an enormous love of jazz and painting and sketching at New York City jazz clubs. I think our paths even crossed back then. And her work is full of movement, it's full of motion. She plays the saxophone in addition to painting. She is an enormous jazz fan. And in fact, the Partay that is going to open her exhibit, which goes through April, it's not just during the festival, her one woman show will go through the middle of April. She'll have Ed Cherry, the guitarist Ed Cherry, joining her. So there'll be music in the galleries on that opening night. And her paintings are exquisite. She's also a fashion designer. But the point is that she has a very deep, long-standing connection to jazz. And that's been the case with all of the artists that we've presented in conjunction with the festival on each of the 3 years that I've currently worked on, including our first one with Reggie Madison, great painter, sculptor, and curator, who put a show together for us in 2020, at the end of 2020. And then with Mike Mosby, curator Mike Mosby, and the group show that he did. But this is our first solo show, and I'm very excited to see Maureen's work in this setting.
So give us the layout of the two-weekend festival.
Sure, absolutely. Well, you know, it's February. It's Black History Month. It is around Valentine's Day. It is also the time that Mardi Gras is beginning to be celebrated, or Carnival, as it was in South America, Carnival time. So there's kind of all these different kind of cultural influences on having the festival at this time of year. Mostly it's a way to kind of bring the community back together after the chilly January snows, and you know, give people a chance to hang out and socialize. So it's a festival for the local community and for visitors to Hudson. There's a lot of people come up from New York or over from Boston. People visit for the weekend, and it's a really eclectic mix of people. And it's two weekends, and some people come to both weekends, and some people just come to one or even a single concert. And so it's planned opening on a Thursday night each weekend. The first night, of course, is the art opening, but then we have three more concerts over the weekend on Friday evening, Saturday evening, and a Sunday matinee performance for those who need to hop in a car or jump on a train to where they might be going. So the first weekend is the beautiful vocalist, and there's a lot of vocals in this year's presentation. Sarah Elizabeth Charles and her band Scope are celebrating their new album Blank Canvas. It's a band that she's had together for many, many years and has evolved with her career. She's a vocalist, composer, educator. She works a lot with incarcerated populations, actually, and I think has been up in New York State associated with that work. And then that weekend is Marquise Hill is on the Saturday night, amazing trumpeter, Chicago originator, beautiful, you know, well-known, world-renowned at this point. Very lucky to have him bring his band with a young upstart, a new musician who will stun audiences by the name of Joel Ross on vibes. And he's very young, but he's beginning to make quite a name for himself and has always been in Marquise's band. And they'll present his new Gospel Revisited project, also a new album. And then that first weekend wraps up with Michael Mayo, who many people compare to Bobby McFerrin, but you know, whether he's with a band or just with loops and just his vocalese is very unique to him and very creative. And he kind of blends more Broadway style and standard jazz, but his improvisations are fascinating and so entertaining. And that's the first weekend. And then the second weekend, again, it's four programs on the second weekend. Drummer Ulysses Owens is coming on the Thursday evening, and then followed by an amazing new project from young vocalists, Lucy Yegazarian and Venetia Gold, called In Her Words. It's music that it comes from a very female perspective, obviously. And with these two young singers who are embarking on a career that they are beginning to make waves in. Lucy just placed first in the Sarah Vaughan vocal competition, and Venetia is an artist in residence at the Jazz Gallery in New York. And then going into the last part of the weekend, I'm very proud to say we're presenting our first world premiere commission with pianist Aaron Parks. He is a phenomenal musician, known for his work with composer and trumpeter Terence Blanchard. And then to cap everything off, we have the amazing India Owens and her band, The Cookout. She's known, of course, as the bassist for the Stephen Colbert, The Late Show, with John Batiste, and now with Louis Cato, holding down the bass chair in that band. But she has her own thing. She's originally from Detroit. She's got a lot of soul, and she's quite a big band, seven or eight musicians we're expecting, including vocals and all kinds of great music. So there's something for everyone, I would say, between the two weekends.
Yes, fabulous, fabulous. And some of the performances will be live streamed.
That's right. We hope that all of the performances that that's the plan, that all of the performance will be live streamed. And in fact, for Endia's performance on that Sunday afternoon, we're collaborating with the wonderful Operation Unite New York and providing a community meal. Endia started an organization called The Cookout. It's not just the name of her band, but it's actually a nonprofit organization that she started during the pandemic that provided meals out on the street. It was a community cookout, and she played music and they made food and they distributed food to those in need all over Harlem and different parts of New York City. So in honor and to raise awareness of that work that she does, we're doing something similar. We can't have a cookout. It's the middle of February. But we're going to have a kind of cook-in. And it'd be called the community meal, the Hudson Community Meal. And what we're doing is delivering meals in collaboration with Operation Unite to homebound seniors, and presenting a community meal in a community setting in a senior center, and setting it up so that everybody will be able to watch the live stream of her concert, those who won't be able to make it to the venue. So I'm really looking forward to that.
Absolutely inspiring. It's just that it's just so lovely.
Top of Sugar Hill to Riverside Drive, Malcolm X down to Harlem River Drive. All our dudes in history rooted deep inside. Take me uptown. Sunday morning, everybody's in their prime. After church, we smile and laugh and then we dine. And we'll dance and even have a glass of wine. Is that
oh, maybe if I look away, he'll look and see. Boy, she's so cool and so free, he'll say. Maybe he'll look this way. Well, maybe if I wear a smile, laugh and pretend that I don't care that he's there, he'll stay. And maybe find a way to try and grab my attention and tell me all the things his eyes clearly say. Maybe I dream, but I know he could be mine if he would only just look this way.
Kat, what were some of your and Hudson Hall's criteria for selecting the talent that you did for this year's festival?
Well, the theme of the festival is the shape of jazz today. And I'm sure you're a jazz aficionado. You know jazz so well. You know this is a riff on Ornette Coleman's album, famous album from 1959, The Shape of Jazz to Come, which really caused a stir for its inventiveness. And we don't intend to present a kind of comprehensive overview of where jazz is today, but there's something about the jazz in the new millennium, and jazz has just celebrated its 100th birthday, that really brings together the fact that musicians are trying to break down the barriers that have traditionally existed between music genres, that you have to be swing, or you have to be inside versus outside, or you have to be your hip hop or your R&B. You know, these genres, there's a generation of musicians, and I think Gen Z epitomizes this, of like, it's all acceptable, it's all music, there are no boundaries. And so I think people's ears have become more accustomed to that. So we selected a group of musicians who also believe that. Marquise Hill has traditionally tried to break down barriers in all of his many albums as a leader. He's very steeped in the tradition. All of the musicians that we're presenting are steeped in the tradition of jazz, and they fluidly move between what is traditionally thought of as inside music versus more experimental, often blues-based expressions, and a very contemporary way of presenting their unique artistry to the world.
Yeah. They're all who I would label as forward-thinking individuals, as you said, utilizing musical elements of other genres in their composing, their playing, and the musical company that they keep.
That's right. Yes. You know, it's like they have bold vision.
Yes.
And taking jazz in new directions, but they're continuing very much to honor the traditions of the past. And, you know, we're looking at a group of composers and artists who are, we have some mid-career, some more established, some very at the beginning of their year, but for the most part, we're looking at a generation that was raised or emerged or grew up in the last part of the 20th century. You know, and if you think about the way that music and music presentation changed since Ornette's The Shape of Jazz to Come, you know, it reflects the sonic environment in which they grew up. This generation came up with an audio landscape that was soul, funk, gospel, R&B, and then, you know, the arrival of hip hop, the advent of DJs creating looping beats, and that continues to evolve the way that music is made with new instruments. I'm sure you remember that when the Moog was invented and the Yamaha, it changed everything, right? It changed the way that music was created from jazz to pop, and an explosion of creativity in that last part of the 20th century. And added to this, you know, technology not only brought new ways of making music, but new access, like global connections, has brought music from around the world into our homes. And I think we like to call it music from other cultures, whereas it used to be called world music, as if it was some other thing. But it's now very much that it's, you know, cultural influences from other musics have been brought into jazz in a way that kind of begun with Coltrane and Yusef Lateef, and even earlier back, you know, you think of Chano Pozo and Dizzy Gillespie. So this is just a new expression of that way of bringing other cultures into what is a uniquely American art form rooted in the African-American cultural tradition.
As an arts consultant versed in jazz programming, if and when you encounter venue curators who balk at the idea of presenting contemporary artists who aren't about interpreting traditional jazz standards all night long, how do you communicate to them their role in keeping jazz and improvised music a vital art form?
That's a great question. Well, the first thing that comes to mind is John Coltrane's My Favorite Things, right? Because that was a pop song And he took it and he created something completely new, and it became iconic. And, you know, acoustic instrumentation is foundation to jazz, but traditional players have been touched by contemporary popular music and instrumentation and the way people think of jazz standards. So for an audience wondering, you know, am I going to hear some old jazz standards? There are a lot of new jazz standards, classic compositions that are always loved for, you know, that familiarity. They appear, but they're presented in new ways. But they're enduring themes. They're, you know, they have catchy melodies, and they're things that audiences can latch onto and are universal in a way that they unite people.
Yep.
But nowadays, I would say that for this festival, alongside standards by Duke Ellington or Thelonious Monk, you might hear what we think of as standards by Stevie Wonder. Or Roy Hargrove, the late great iconic Roy Hargrove, or somebody like Jaco Pastorius, or even A Tribe Called Quest. You know, there's a great Brad Mehldau album that includes Blackbird, the Beatles' Blackbird, and music from Nirvana. Smells Like Teen Spirit. So I think, you know, that's what we appreciate about audiences, is that they can see in these musicians that they will honor and bring music from the past. And you will hear a lot of that, but it might not be in a way that you're expecting. And yet we are very focused on allowing musicians and composers to present their own work, their own original music, which is often inspired by those who came before them.
Kat, you're the executive director of the Live Music Society, an organization that supports initiatives that promote and preserve the performance and experience of live music. It not only offers funding, it also offers assistance in areas like audience outreach, sound design, and fundraising. How challenging was the shift from doing what the Live Music Society was doing at the time to generating more funding for venues in need during the lockdowns at the height of the COVID-19 pandemic?
Actually, I'm going to have to stop you there because we haven't made that shift. I think we're going to have to revisit that question a little, Cheryl, because what we're doing now is grant making. And I'm not sure if there's a way to kind of edit that out of the.
Oh, yeah, it's data. Done.
Yeah.
So that's totally fine.
I would love to talk to you about Live Music Society.
Oh, sure.
The question and the thing that we've been grappling with, I've been there for just over a year, and maybe the question that is relevant is how we're moving from emergency funding into something that is more optimistic. You know, that's big. I'm about to announce a new grant cycle next month, actually, and I'd love to share that with your listeners. And we haven't figured out how to help venues fundraise other than our grant making. You know, between you and me, we're still looking at maybe doing some grant making that helps people with, like, you know, building a disabled ramp or updating their bathrooms or recovering the stage. So we're working on this stuff. But what we've done so far is emergency funding. And what we're doing in 2023 is going to be more about audience development and community engagement. So that's the question I think I would love to respond to.
Well, you know what? Why don't you start in with it? I'll just, of course, edit that out, but I will put in a question. And why don't you just answer it as you'd like to? Boom. Right. Go right ahead.
Yes, I am honored to serve as the executive director of Live Music Society. It is a new organization, a new foundation that started actually weeks before the pandemic hit. In 2019, a group of music industry professionals and philanthropists got together and wanted to do something to help the listening rooms, the smallest venues across the United States, help them be better, help them to be able to take care of artists, help them to work with each other. And so they had just come to the creation of an idea and a concept and a business plan and registered the nonprofit when the pandemic hit, and they swiftly shifted towards emergency funding. And I'm very pleased to say that we have helped in some way, I hope, to keep some of those music venues across America open and help them survive the pandemic. We were able to distribute $2.3 million to 126 venues in the first couple of years of our operation. And now, as we're going into 2023, we're going to be announcing a new kind of grant program. It's embargoed until next month. We'll be announcing it in the middle of February, but the concept will be not so much doom and gloom, not about survival, not about emergency funding, but about reconnecting with audiences, developing your audiences, reaching out to people who may have felt, as if they didn't belong, creating new revenue streams. These are the ideas of how we help venues recover and hopefully achieve long-term sustainability. It's tough out there with inflation and with rising costs, and even people have been canceling tours. So there's a lot to do to ensure the safety and the stability, but it's so worth it. It's so much part of American culture. It's part of what brings communities together. It's low cost access to culture is the local music venue, helping people get their start in music. A great night out, to be in an intimate space where you can really create a connection with an artist or between an artist and an audience. So we're championing small venues and quite evangelical about that. Not just jazz venues. These are all kinds of listening rooms, Americana, folk, even punk, thrash metal. We have some great grantees that are all ages venues, where teenagers have a safe space to go play music and learn new skills. So it's a vast array of different grantees across America.
This concludes my interview with Kat Henry, Arts Executive and Curator of the 2023 Hudson Jazz Festival. The festival is scheduled over two weekends, February 16th through February 19th, and February 23rd through February 26th, and takes place at Hudson Hall in Hudson, New York. For more information, hudsonhall.org. Thank you for tuning in to Situation Fluxus, produced for WGXC, 90.7 FM, listener-supported radio for open ears in upstate New York. I've been your host, Cheryl Kay. Tune in next week for another show. For more information about Situation Fluxus, thejazzdisturbance@gmail.com or jazzfluxus.com. Thank you.